This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, hosting comparative coffee and tea tastings all month at Pete's 7 Portland locations, including new locations on Hawthorne and in Vancouver. Details at PEETS.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Oregon Secretary of State expects a record turnout on Election Day next week. Bechtel Corporation pulls out of Iraq, blaming the high number of its workers killed in the conflict. And demonstrators are still fighting the police in Oaxaca, Mexico.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,821 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 50,022 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. A report released by The Lancet puts the number at more than 600,000 civilians dead. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, November 2nd, 2006. I'm Sun Lee.
Hello, Sun, and I'm Marlies Franklin. An overwhelmed dog breeder in the St. Helens area today surrendered more than 36 Golden Doodle and Labradoodle dogs to the Oregon Humane Society. The dogs, including 25 puppies, arrived this afternoon at the OHS shelter at 1067 Northeast Columbia Boulevard, in Portland, effectively swamping the facility.
Senator Ron Wyden said today he would block confirmation of a top federal environmental official until the Bush administration sets a national minimum standard for the cancer-causing substance benzene in gasoline. Because the Pacific Northwest has cleaner air than in other parts of the country, the Oregon Democrat said the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency allows refiners to distribute gasoline with higher benzene content than anywhere else. Much of Northwest gasoline comes from benzene-rich oil from Alaska. Gas from Alaska has nearly twice as much benzene as the national average.
The high cost of prescription drugs is a hot issue this election season. The retail giant Walmart jumped into the fray last month, offering $4 prescriptions on a limited number of generic drugs. A new analysis from Oregonians for Health Security shows the state's bulk purchasing plan actually saves consumers more. KABU's Michael Monkvold has the story.
The ever-increasing cost of prescription drugs has consumers without drug coverage flocking to the retail giant Walmart after its recent promise of $4 prescriptions on some generic pharmaceuticals. But a new analysis from Oregonians for Health Security shows that the state's bulk purchasing pool, the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, actually saves consumers more on drugs, including brand names. Maribeth Healy from Prescription for a Healthy Oregon says that's why it's important to expand the plan.
It gives us, as Oregonians, the same negotiating power as a big box chain.
Ballot Measure 44 would expand the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to any Oregon resident without prescription drug coverage, something Healy says is essential.
There are thousands of Oregonians who have realized 60% savings on their pharmaceuticals through this program, but there are over 1 million Oregonians who have no access to prescription drugs except to pay the highest price.
The Oregon News Service contributed to this report. I'm Mike Monkvold, KABU News.
Gotten regulatory go-aheads for drilling tests in the Coos Bay estuary. The Williams Pipeline Company proposed a 233-mile gas pipeline from a liquefied natural gas terminal to Mahlon in eastern Oregon, where the gas would intersect a major north-south pipeline. Company officials said Coos Bay's residents objected to a pipeline route that went through their property, so the company decided to examine a route through the bay. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Oregon Department of State Lands have both approved the test. The city of Coos Bay has granted a permit subject to a 15-day appeal period that ends Friday. Oregon's Secretary of State, Bill Bradbury, today said he predicts 71% of Oregon's registered voters will be casting ballots in this election. If his predictions come true, that would mean nearly 1.5 million voters will cast ballots. That's slightly higher than the percentage cast in the last two gubernatorial elections in 2002, which has 68.2% participation. Remember, ballots must be received by election officials by 8 p.m. on Election Day, Tuesday, November 7th. A listing of drop sites, their hours, and a map of each can be found at www.oregonvotes.org.
In eastern Oregon this week, the Port of Morrow Commission has approved leasing property for a sixth biofuel project in Boardman. Port officials said the EXL 3 group has proposed a biodiesel plant that would produce up to 60 million gallons per year and employ 36 people. The Port of Morrow has already leased property to Pacific Ethanol and Ultra Incorporated. The Pacific Ethanol plant should be completed in June and employ 35. It is expected to produce up to 35 million gallons per year. Ultra plans to build a biodiesel plant in January that would produce 40 million gallons a year and employ 20. Three other companies have also signed letters saying they intend to lease port property. Once again, an overwhelmed dog breeder in the St. Helens area today surrendered more than three dozen golden doodle and labradoodle dogs to the Humane Society. It's not funny. It's just the sounding of the words. The dogs, including 25 puppies, have arrived this afternoon at the OHS shelter at 1067 Northeast Columbia Boulevard, and they are effectively swamping the facility. Doodle dogs are considered a kind of designer hybrid because they are reportedly less likely to trigger allergic reactions in humans. New families for the dogs are needed as soon as possible. Officials said all the animals, including a mother with 7 newborn pups, will receive immediate medical attention and be offered for adoption as soon as possible. Please find out more at www.oregonhumane.org or call 503-285-7722.
The Washington State Patrol says 2,000 gallons of diesel that spilled from a train near Clay Elum was contained near the tracks and did not reach environmentally sensitive areas. A Burlington Northern Santa Fe train ran over a boulder Tuesday, rupturing a fuel tank about 7 miles west of Clay Elum. The train did not derail. The fuel spilled over a one-mile stretch and was cleaned up by hazardous materials workers under the oversight of the State Ecology Department.
In northern Washington state, a deal has been completed to add 82 acres of privately owned tidelands near Anacortes to the Fidalgo Bay Aquatic Reserve. The Skagit Land Trust, State Department of Natural Resources, and Texaco were parties to the agreement that brings the reserve to 532 acres. The tideland is filled with eelgrass that shelters salmon and crabs.
Inspector generals at two different agencies have opened investigations into the silencing of government scientists on global warming. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, the suppression of information in the Bush administration is nothing new, according to public interest groups.
After increasing pressure from members of Congress, investigations into the government's suppression of science have been announced. In September, Senator Lautenberg, Democrat from New Jersey, wrote a letter to the Inspectors General of the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and also the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. The letter, signed by 13 fellow senators, cites a recent report withheld by NOAA that shows a link between global warming and last year's devastating hurricane season. The letter also cites that a politically appointed NOAA spokesperson prohibited a staff scientist, Thomas Knutson, from speaking about the effect global warming could have had on Hurricanes Wilma, Rita, and Katrina's magnitude. And ranking member of the House Government Reform Committee, Henry Waxman from California, posted to his website emails that detail the exchange between the NOAA spokesperson and a fellow colleague that denied media access to Knutson. And over at NASA, scientist Jim Henson, director of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, claimed that he was silenced because of the scientific research he's done on global warming. Senator Lautenberg wrote in a statement, quote, "The Inspector General investigations are going to shake up the administration because it will uncover internal documents and agency correspondence that may expose widespread misconduct." Brendan Bell is global warming spokesperson for the Sierra Club.
The first time it got into office, the Bush administration has really tried to push the science on global warming underground. And even when he gets reports from its own scientists that we do need to respond to climate change, it's ignored them. So I think it is good that there is some oversight happening at the two agencies, but really the problem is at the top because the Bush administration has its head in the sand on global warming.
NASA and NOAA are not the only two agencies alleged to suppress scientific information, but also the Environmental Protection Agency. Brendan Bell calls it censorship.
There's just been across the board a censorship of actual peer-reviewed science and a decrease in funding to actually go out and find out what do we need to do and what do we need to understand about the fact that our climate is changing.
For the first few years of his presidency, President Bush dismissed the notion of global warming as unfounded. He pulled the U.S. from the Kyoto Treaty, which works to decrease the amount of greenhouse gases, which many believe is a main contributor to global warming. But critics say the suppression of information that disputes the administration's views are not unique to global warming. David Becker is a staff attorney for People of the American Way. They filed a Freedom of Information Act request to find out why the Election Assistance Commission has been sitting on a report for several months that reveals there is no evidence that voter fraud is being committed by lying about identity, voting twice, or claiming the names of the deceased. That's despite claims by politicians who favor strict voter identification regulations.
Certainly when taxpayer money is going to fund studies that are important. You were talking about global warming. We're talking about the right to vote and very, very important things. It's necessary for the government to take some serious account of the public's right to access this information that they, in fact, paid for.
And in another claim of information suppression, some Democrats are decrying the holding of a report by the Department of Agriculture on hunger. The USDA said they're going to release it mid-November after the elections. The annual report is often released in October. But Terry Tiber, spokesperson for the Department of Agriculture, says it's the Democrats who are playing election year politics.
There was absolutely no political pressure to delay this report. This was an agency decision. The agency head will tell you that.
As for the investigation into the climate change cover-up, the results are expected to be released early next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The leader of the influential National Association of Evangelicals, a vocal opponent of the drive for same-sex marriage, resigned today after being accused of paying for sex with a man. The Reverend Ted Haggard also stepped aside as his head of 14,000-member megachurch while a church panel investigates. The resignation came after a 49-year-old man told a Denver radio station that Haggard paid him to have sex. Haggard, a married father of five, denied the allegations late yesterday. Haggard's alleged sex partner told the Associated Press that Haggard paid him to have sex nearly every month for 3 years.
Catherine Jeffers Shorey, the first woman to serve as presiding bishop since the Episcopal Church approved women priests 30 years ago, will begin her 9-year term this weekend. But as the Miami Herald reports today, she is already facing dissent within her flock. About 10 Episcopal dioceses have rejected her authority, arguing her support for same-sex blessings and the ordination of lay clergy runs counter to biblical morality. In her first sermon following her election at the church's general convention in June, Jeffers Shorey angered the church's conservative wing by referring to Mother Jesus.
Democrats are blaming politics for the Bush administration's decision to wait until after the election to issue a report on hunger in the United States. The Agriculture Department report has generally been released in October, a month after annual poverty figures are released by the Census Bureau. USDA officials said the report has long been set for a mid-November release and that the delay is not political. In 2004, the report showed 38 million people in the U.S. were struggling with hunger.
Marla Ruzicka was the first American to set up a compensation fund for victims of U.S. aggression in Iraq and Afghanistan. She was killed by a suicide bomber earlier this year. Tonight, one of her best friends, Jennifer Abramson, speaks about Marla's life.
She was a young activist from San Francisco and through a series of events ended up in Afghanistan itself shortly after 9/11 when the bombing campaign was going on at that time. And she stumbled into a number of refugees who had been fleeing the war over into Pakistan, and she was absolutely shocked and horrified when she heard the stories of the innocent civilians who had lost homes and loved ones, and they weren't being helped or assisted by anybody. And she was very young. She was 24 years old at the time, and to a certain extent, perhaps it was her naivete that led her to decide to take on their issue herself. And she eventually was very successful in doing so, bringing their cases to Washington and changing legislation to guarantee war victims assistance for the first time in U.S. history.
One of the things that is remarkable to me about the story of Marla Ruzicka is her own battle with mental health. We often see people in our communities demonized because of their relative mental health. To me, it seems like maybe that's part of why she was so successful. Am I imagining that?
No, you're not imagining that her struggles with bipolar disorder led her to take on such enormous challenges in her life. And she wanted to destigmatize the condition, and she was coming to terms with it. She was only diagnosed a year before she was killed, but she was coming to terms with it, and she wanted other young people like herself to know that despite being mentally crippled to a certain extent, that dreams could be carried out, that pain could be channeled into something positive, turn the pain into something positive to make a difference in the world, to make the world a better place. And she did credit the wild manias that would grip her at times to the energy, levels of energy that brought her into the war zones and made her basically fearless to a certain extent during, you know, certain episodes of her life. I think overall she was also... she really struggled with the downs, with the deep depression she would go into. And so I think the two balanced them, balance each other out. She would fall into slumps, but then the energies would really galvanize her, pushing her forward to do the right thing, to help as many people as possible. And to a certain extent, yes, it was that condition that helped her. But she wanted others to believe that no matter what your personal struggles are, and we all have them, that you can channel that into something positive rather than just dwell on the negative.
We're speaking with Jennifer Abrahamson. Her new book is called Sweet Relief, The Marla Ruzicka Story. Jennifer, this is not just a biography. It's not just a book. When I read through this book, I got the impression it was, in a sense, a call to action. What would you like to see happen as a result of this book?
Yeah, this book is a call to action. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. Marla really saw this book as an advocacy tool to bring Americans, to bring their consciousness to the forefront of the struggles of civilians in this war in Iraq and also the one in Afghanistan as well. And she wanted Americans to become aware of the issues that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have been affected by the ongoing violence, and that it, as Americans, it's our responsibility to compensate them, to acknowledge their suffering, and in a way, in a sense, working to win back some hearts and minds that we've sorely lost. And now that Marla's voice has been silenced, I hope that this book can serve as her own voice after death. And it is, as you said, much more than a biography. This is a call to the American public to stand up and do something, whatever they can, whether it's just giving a donation to Marla's organization, which still exists, or writing a letter to their local congressperson. I mean, this is an issue that really needs to be highlighted and taken further to those in power in Washington.
Jennifer Abramson speaks tonight about the legacy of Marla Ruzicka, and that's at 7 p.m. at Borders Books, located at 708 Southwest 3rd Avenue.
Bechtel Corporation is pulling out of Iraq after 3 years of work that cost the lives of 52 of its workers and earning $1.03 billion in U.S. contracts. A company spokesman says the deaths are moving the greatest losses of life that Bechtel has suffered during any job in its 108-year history. The death toll is possibly exceeded only by the work Bechtel did on the Hoover Dam during the Depression. Bechtel is the largest construction engineering company in the world. Critics have charged it with mismanagement and corrupt practices in the Big Dig project in Boston. The corporation has also been linked to financial dealings within the bin Laden family. Bechtel had hired as many as 40,000 workers, mostly Iraqi subcontractors, while it supposedly worked on rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure. A company spokesman says most of the workers were killed while off duty.
President Bush says he has not received any requests to send more American forces to Iraq, and that commanders have told him the 144,000 troops already deployed there are, quote, what they can live with. Bush spoke in an interview with the Associated Press and others yesterday, a day before he headed out for 5 days of campaigning up to Election Day. Discounting mounting predictions that Republicans will lose control of the House, Bush expressed confidence that his party would maintain its grip on both the Senate and House. He plans to vote next week in Crawford, Texas, and then fly back to Washington to await returns at the White House.
President Bush is campaigning for Western Republicans today amid worrisome indicators from a new poll. A CBS News and New York Times survey suggests only 29% of Americans approve of the president's handling of the Iraq war, the lowest war approval rating of the Bush presidency. A whopping 80% say Bush's latest approach to drumming up support for his Iraq campaign amounts to a change in language, but not policy. Democrats have at least an 18-point lead in the poll of likely voters. Bush is trying to help the struggling GOP in Montana and Nevada before heading to Missouri.
The rival sides in South Dakota's historic vote on abortion are each claiming their position protects women's health. This is an old argument on the abortion rights side, but a new campaign tactic for the anti-abortion advocates. With more in this story, here's Jenna Thompson.
Rather than stressing a fetus's right to live or vilifying abortion providers, the Vote Yes for Life campaign is focused on depicting abortion as psychologically harmful to women. At stake is a South Dakota law passed earlier this year that would ban virtually all abortions. Voters will decide Tuesday whether to reject this toughest in the nation ban or uphold it, likely triggering a lawsuit that could lead to the U.S. Supreme Court. The South Dakota Campaign for Healthy Families, which opposes the abortion ban, leads in the polls, but it still has found this new strategy challenging to counter. It says there is no scientific evidence of pervasive psychological or medical problems among women who had abortions. Nationally, groups like Silent No More and Operation Outcry are mobilizing women who had abortions to campaign against abortion rights, often using words like empowerment that recall previous feminist campaigns. Abortion rights activists acknowledge that some women struggle emotionally after abortions, but say most do not. Susan Cohen of the Guttmacher Institute noted that roughly one-third of American women have an abortion. Quote, if abortion were so harmful, we'd see a mass epidemic of women with severe mental health problems. But there is no such mass problem. There has been no comprehensive, broadly accepted U.S. study quantifying abortion's psychological impact. The American Psychological Association says there is no such thing as a post-abortion syndrome. Abortion critics cite a 1989 article from Science magazine that suggests that up to 10% of women who had abortions experienced depressive symptoms of a lingering nature. Pro-choice groups say that not only are the studies out of date, but they are also full of junk science. I'm Jenna Thompson, KBOO News.
In Southern California and Anaheim, city council candidate accused of supporting Islamic extremists by a powerful GOP operative has switched his party affiliation. Bill Dalati is now a registered Democrat. Dalati, a naturalized U.S. citizen born in Syria, was criticized in a letter last month by former state Republican Party chair Sean Steele. Dalati said he tried unsuccessfully to speak with GOP officials about the letter, which accused him of helping sponsor an anti-Israel rally and associating with, quote, zany left-wing groups, end quote. The city council is a nonpartisan office. Dalati says he, quote, didn't feel wanted by the Republican Party. He says the rally mentioned in the letter was an anti-war protest and denies ties to Hezbollah.
In an election season noted for its vitriol, Republican Martha Rainville and Democrat Peter Welch of Virginia are running campaigns free of personal attacks. The contest is for an open seat being vacated by Representative Bernie Sanders, an independent who is running for the Senate. Party leaders and the campaigns of the House candidates say it's the only contested race in the country, accentuating the positive. Rainville challenged Welch to sign what she called a clean campaign pledge that included voluntary spending limits. Welch, the present pro tem of the state Senate, didn't sign the pledge, but said he agreed with its goal.
The South Dakota State Senate is scheduled to convene in a special session November 27th to look into allegations that Democratic Senator Dan Sutton sexually groped an 18-year-old page. After hearing evidence, the Senate could take actions ranging from imposing no punishment up to expelling Sutton. State investigators have not filed criminal charges. Senate President Pro Tem Len Schoenbeck said he sent a letter to Sutton on October 12th, the day after the former page's father filed a formal complaint, alleging that Sutton invited the page to stay overnight in his motel room and then groped him. The letter told Sutton that if he did not resign within a week, the Senate would start formal proceedings to investigate and possibly punish him.
Mexico's Federal Preventative Police continued to carry out actions to quell the popular rebellion in the southern state of Oaxaca. After breaking up the main barricade on the superhighway that enters Oaxaca City from Mexico City yesterday and taking over the occupied facilities of the state-run TV and radio station, federal troops with helicopters and armored vehicles have now surrounded the campus of the state university. Members of the popular movement demanding the ouster of Oaxaca's governor have barricaded themselves inside the university's radio station. Shannon Young and Vladimir Flores report from Oaxaca City.
This morning, the militarized federal police force known as the PFP, along with shock groups associated with the ruling PRI party, surrounded the campus of the Benito Juarez Autonomous University of Oaxaca, where dissident students and faculty have been broadcasting from the university's radio station.
We're not going to permit them to advance towards Radio Universidad. We know that they're going to do the dirty work to open the way for the paramilitaries, which just moments ago shot at our friends as we were on our way in here.
Thousands of Oaxaca City's residents rushed to the scene in response to appeals for help sent out over the airwaves. The PFP responded with beatings, tear gas, and water cannons. FSRN has received numerous reports of arrests and serious head injuries. As of deadline, the police operation was still underway. Again, an excerpt of today's broadcast on the university radio station.
Continúan sobrevolando por los aires el campus de Ciudad Universitaria.
The helicopters keep flying over the airspace of the university campus. They keep trying to intimidate us. They continue to violently attack the people of Oaxaca and our compañeros from the university. We condemn these acts and repeat once again that Vicente Fox is responsible for the red stain on our Oaxaca. At the same time, we say to Felipe Calderon that if Ulises Ruiz doesn't leave the state's governor's office, that he will never become the president of our country. So we are making a call at the national level for a massive mobilization to prevent that despot Felipe Calderon from positioning himself in the presidency of our country.
Today's operation comes after police yesterday took over two key positions held by the movement demanding the resignation of Governor Ulises Ruiz. The PFP dismantled the huge barricade and encampment blockading the superhighway from Mexico City and took over the studios of Corte V, the state-run television and radio station, which was taken over by a large group of women on August 1st. This teacher spoke to Indy Media Oaxaca shortly after the operation at Corte V, also referred to locally as Channel 9.
Encontraron unos compañeros que no pusieron ninguna resistencia para el retiro de las barricadas. Sin embargo, arbitrariamente...
The police found some of our friends who did not resist the withdrawal of the barricades. Nonetheless, they were beaten and arbitrarily loaded onto a truck and moved to a location that, up until now, we don't know. There are five compañeros. We still don't know their names, and we're trying to figure out who they are exactly. But we know that they live around here. Just afterwards, here in Channel 9, a helicopter landed and took away the detainees. A lot of people. We don't know the exact number. We know that some were taken to the state attorney general's office, and we know that among them was a 13-year-old boy.
Meanwhile, 17 teachers and members of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca are 2.5 weeks into a hunger strike in Mexico City. 4 of the original 21 hunger strikers have since been hospitalized. Yesterday, a Zapatista delegation visited the hunger strikers in Mexico City. Zapatista commander Miriam.
Nosotros estamos aquí para luchar y enfrente en alto. No tenemos vergüenza de nada.
We're here to fight with our heads held high. We have nothing to be ashamed of because we're doing nothing more than fighting for our rights. But Fox is a traitor who doesn't even know how to resolve the demand of the people, but sends in repression instead. We don't want a murderous government anymore. We want Ulises Ruiz to leave. Why does he stay there when the people say that they no longer want him?
qué queda ahí cuando el pueblo dice que ya no lo quiere?
Zapatista-based communities blockaded roads and highways throughout the neighboring state of Chiapas yesterday, and plans are in the works for a national strike on November 20th. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young with Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca City.
While protesters in Oaxaca continue to battle the police, activists around the globe are planning actions to support the Mexican demonstrators. KBOO's Trillium Shannon spoke today with Ann Miller Francis, an Oaxacan resident now stranded in Portland.
What is going on? What is the background to the situation?
Teachers have been under-supported for many, many, many years and have been demonstrating every year as long as I've been in Oaxaca, 16 years. But this year, the turning point that led to the people's support for the teachers has been their choice to take on the removal of the corrupt governor, Ulises Ruiz. He has ravaged Oaxaca. He has instituted a series of work projects that fed money into his business associates, who then directed that money towards the fraudulent presidential election on the national level. He touched, by doing that, the heart of the city. The Zocalo is tremendously important to the people of Oaxaca, as are certain monuments, certain parks, and he has literally stripped those locations and replaced the old cantera with new stones. You could say he's whitewashed Oaxaca.
So here you are in Portland when this is going on. What kind of organizing has been happening locally in solidarity with the people's movement in Oaxaca?
Actually, Portlanders, I'm finding, are tremendously sophisticated in their organization and incredibly well informed. They responded immediately by organizing a demonstration that was well attended in front of the consulate, and there was a lot of media present, and there have been some excellent reports coming out in various newspapers and over the radio stations.
Have you been outside the consulate protesting? Have you gone inside?
Well, today when I found out that the radio station was surrounded and that APO had made the decision to defend the radio station, let me interject that a dominant tool for information as the radio has been, and Radio Universidad opened its mics to people from the beginning of this movement. Anybody who wanted to talk has been taking advantage of that radio station. And so you hear somebody from the Sierras, somebody from the school, a university professor, a housewife. It's an incredibly rich experience. Of course, the military want to still that voice. So I went to the consulate today to speak directly with the consul there, and I delivered a letter, and I also expressed my opinion, and I think that's the most important thing. It's one thing to call on the phone, send faxes and emails, but there's nothing as powerful as actually looking somebody in the eye and expressing your opinion. There's an information line at the consulate where anybody can speak with the consul. It's important to be respectful of the Mexican people who are there, but everybody's welcome. The place is open from 8:30 to 2. It's also open in the evenings. I encourage people to go there and deliver a written text. That's something that the consul has agreed to convey to the Mexican government within the country of Mexico. I will give you the contact information for the consul too, 1234 Southwest Morrison. And again, the hours are 8:30 to 2, and in the evenings, the consul's open too. The number is 503-274-1442. I'll mention now what I was told at the consulate, and this is the official government statement to the public. According to the government, there have been no deaths since the troops entered on Friday. No one has died. Brad Will has not died. This sort of incorrect information, it's important to address. So it's not only important that the violence against the people in Oaxaca be stopped, but it's also important that accurate information be relayed to the public. I also want to point out that not only are we working on behalf of Oaxacan teachers and students and the people of Oaxaca, but also in support of education everywhere. And we're also working on behalf of a Portlander, a young woman who is on the barricades in Oaxaca. She's a very intelligent, very well-informed student who has been there for several weeks now. So remember Kate when you speak with the consulate, too. Of course, what's going on in Oaxaca is much, much deeper than the teachers. And economically, farmers in Oaxaca have been undermined by the free trade agreement. At this point, if you go to a market in Oaxaca, you can find pears from Washington, apples from Oregon, and you won't find the delicious fruit that's grown in Oaxaca because the farmers there can't afford to sell their fruit at a lower price than the subsidized farmers of the United States.
What might be coming up as far as planned actions?
The fraudulently elected president of Mexico, Felipe Calderon, will be visiting George Bush in Washington, D.C. So that's a very important date to mobilize. That would be a good day to go to the consulate, for example, again. It's good to go more than once. It's good to spread the information about Oaxaca and, of course, inform yourself. And there's a tremendous amount of information available over the Internet, in-depth information. If you need contact information, addresses, phone numbers, etc., you're welcome to contact me through my email, which is blancanegro@earthlink.net. That's blancanegro@earthlink.net.
That was Oaxaca resident Ann Miller Francis.
The current time is 5:37, and now, time for another Rootin' Tootin' Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
By gollies, our Congress critters had finally done something about illegal immigration. Just in time for November's congressional elections, Republican leaders passed a bill to erect a 700-mile wall along the Mexican border. That'll slam the door on the problem, won't it? No. First of all, the border's 2,000 miles long, not 700. Does it not occur to our stalwart leaders that the coyotes, the border crossing guides who hire out to escort Mexicans across the border, will merely move into the gaps? Second, while our Congress loudly crowed about passing their bill, they provided no money to build the wall. Not a dime. Nor did they deal with such touchy problems as having to condemn private property for the fence and coping with rough terrain that's not suitable for sustaining such a massive structure. Also, they didn't actually mandate that the thing be built, instead delegating that decision to the Homeland Security Czar. Third, and most significant, a fence does nothing about the root causes of immigration. It's a waste of money, says the South Texas rancher with long experience seeing people cross the border. They'll either go through it, over it, or under it, he says flatly. That's because the combo of staggering poverty and innovative human spirit will propel people to seek a better life. Until that poverty is addressed, no fence and no amount of congressional hot air will make a difference in the desperate flow of immigration. This is Jim Hightower saying, indeed, all along the border area, the very idea of the fence is so despised by Anglos and Mexicanos alike that it's angrily referred to as the Berlin Wall, designed to keep Mexicans in and divide friends, family, neighbors, and trading partners from each other. Meanwhile, local folks are doubly riled by a bitter irony. That is, that if the fence ever is built, the job will probably go to Halliburton and be constructed by illegal Mexican labor.
This Jim Hightower Common Sense Commentary is brought to you by the Marijuana Policy Project Foundation. To learn more, visit www.joinmpp.org or call toll-free 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Stay tuned for Africa on Fire at 6 p.m. following our newscast, and at 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. Fall rains throughout the region, daytime highs around 50 degrees, and nighttime lows around 40 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The Israeli army killed 13 Palestinians and wounded dozens of others in the last 24 hours in an attack on the northern Gaza Strip city of Beit Hanun. Free Speech Radio News' Rami Amekhari reports from Gaza.
Palestinian medical sources reported today that Israeli army fire killed 5 Palestinian residents and wounded 15 others, including women and children. The town has been under an Israeli military-imposed curfew since yesterday. Eyewitness Fadin Suhwail told Afas Oran that the Israeli army has tightened its siege of the city.
The Nasser Mosque is now besieged. As there are number of killed inside, there are also resistance fighters in the mosque. There has been a warning to shell or storm the mosque, whilst dozens of local women have protested peacefully.
The Israeli government claims its military offensive in Beit Hanun is aimed at preventing armed Palestinian groups opposed to the Israeli occupation of firing of homemade rockets on nearby Israeli towns. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called the attack a massacre. From IMEMC, for Afasar An, I am Rami Al-Mighari, reporting from Gaza.
Syria and Iran are denying Bush administration's accusations that they are pursuing the overthrow of the Lebanese government. Kat Aaron has more.
The White House said Wednesday that it is concerned about what it called mounting evidence that the two nations are collaborating with the Lebanon-based Hezbollah resistance group to oust the government of Fuad Sanyura, which has the support of the United States. Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah deny the charges, and Syria is demanding that the U.S. make public any evidence it has of its alleged involvement in efforts to take down the Sanyura administration. White House spokesperson Tony Snow said it serves what he called an important diplomatic purpose to keep the information classified. When a reporter suggested the administration's charges were weighty enough to require at least some characterization of the evidence, here's how Snow responded.
No, but thanks for the advice.
The allegations came a day after Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah demanded that Prime Minister Sanyura form a unity government or face protests seeking a new election. Nasrallah has given a deadline of mid-November. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kat Aaron in New York.
Iran's military has test-fired dozens of missiles in central Iran at the start of a week and a half of military maneuvers. The missiles include the Shahab-3, which is capable of carrying a nuclear warhead and has a range of 2,000 kilometers. Iran's Revolutionary Guard chief said the maneuvers are a show of the country's defensive capabilities. The tests come as the UN Security Council is considering sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. Iran says its nuclear program is for civilian purposes.
Russia and China indicated they will not support a draft UN resolution imposing tough sanctions on Iran. The resolution is in response to Iran's refusal to halt its nuclear enrichment program. The comments by Russia's foreign minister and China's UN ambassador were the strongest reactions yet and signaled difficult negotiations ahead on the resolution drawn up by Britain, France, and Germany. China's UN ambassador said, quote, "There are still different views on what kind of actions the Council needs to do under the current circumstances."
Peru's president, Alan Garcia, announced that he will have Congress consider applying the death penalty to punish those convicted of terrorism. Garcia wants Congress to convert an existing constitutional article against treason into a civil code against terrorism after recent rumors of a possible resurgence of Shining Path members in universities and unions. Meanwhile, the Peruvian chapter of Amnesty International is criticizing a new law proposed by Congress members who support Peru's former president, Alberto Fujimori. Amnesty says the proposed law, which would intervene in the activities of non-governmental organizations, would be terrible for Peruvian society. Pamela Cueva reports.
The Peruvian Agency of International Cooperation, APSI, a government agency, is proposing a law that would require all NGOs to register their activities with Peru's central government. The president of Peru's Consumer Defense Commission, Johnny Lescano, cautioned President Garcia that the application of this law could signal the start of an authoritarian government. And there's been outcry from different sectors of Peruvian society that the law would give too much control over NGOs to the government. An Amnesty International spokesperson said that the agencies of international cooperation finance projects with high restrictions. They demand more stringent reporting than is now required of NGOs. In Peru, NGOs make important contributions in society by developing programs and addressing issues where the government is absent. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros.
Colombia's government is rushing troops to an area near the Caribbean coast. The move comes after the latest in a string of attacks by members of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC. The attacks have shaken public confidence in the government's hardline military strategy for the nation's civil war. Mike Caesar reports from Bogota.
The attack yesterday morning killed 2 civilians and 17 soldiers and police officers. Fighters attacked the town of Tierra Adentro, about 200 miles northwest of Bogota, Colombia's capital, then retreated back into the hills. The guerrillas have been fighting a four-decade civil war to overthrow Colombia's elected government. Yesterday's attack follows 2 recent bombings, one in a military university in Bogota. The surge in attacks has raised new doubts about Colombian President Álvaro Uribe's policy of defeating the guerrillas through a military offensive, which is largely financed by the U.S. government. In recent days, the FARC also attacked electricity transmission lines in North Santander Department on the Venezuelan border, knocking out power for thousands of people. Also in North Santander, some 60 local officials have resigned this year because of guerrilla death threats. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mike Caesar.
2 foreign oil workers from Britain and the United States are missing from Nigeria's Niger Delta region. Sam Orikoya reports from Lagos.
Armed men abducted the 2 foreign oil workers early this morning from an oil ship operated by the Norwegian company Petroleum Geoservices. No group has claimed responsibility. There are numerous armed groups operating in the Niger Delta. In recent months, the groups have stepped up attacks on oil installations and kidnapped about 40 foreign oil workers. The armed groups want local communities to have a share of oil proceeds. Billions of dollars made yearly from oil sales in the region is shared mainly between the Nigerian government and Western oil companies. Though the oil industry has been active for more than 4 decades in the Niger Delta, local communities which derive little benefit from the industry remain very poor. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Russia's state-controlled natural gas monopoly said today that it would more than double the price it charges Georgia. This only led to further tensions between the ex-Soviet neighbors. The gas announcement came as Georgia's foreign minister is visiting Moscow in the hope of easing conflict between the two countries. Tensions rose after Georgia briefly detained 4 purported Russian spies in late September. Moscow responded with a transport and postal blockade on Georgia and a crackdown on Georgian migrants living in Russia. Relations have steadily deteriorated since the 2004 election of the Georgian president, who has sought to bolster ties with the West and join NATO in 2008.
Thousands of opposition protesters have gathered in Kyrgyzstan, capital of Bishkek, demanding the resignation of President Kurmanbekov. They accuse him of breaking a pledge to hand more power to the parliament and cabinet. President Bakiyev came to power in 2005 after protesters drove out his predecessor, Askar Akayev. He has asked opposition leaders to return to the negotiating table.
Israeli leadership is calling a letter from President Bush historic. Sent on Tuesday, the written statement is the first time the U.S. government has fully recognized Israeli settlements on Palestinian land as a legitimate part of Israel. It also denied Palestinian refugees their internationally recognized right to return to their homes. The letter arrived just before Israel approved its largest war budget ever today. FSRN's Jenka Soderberg reports from Jerusalem.
Outgoing Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Daniel Ayalon, announced Tuesday the letter from George W. Bush in which the U.S. government has taken an unprecedented position that violates all previous agreements with the Palestinians in favor of unilateral land takeovers by Israel of large swaths of Palestinian land. Ayalon stated that he believes the letter is of equal import to the Balfour Declaration, the 1917 British declaration that first called for a Jewish state on the land of Palestine, though the Jewish state wasn't actually created until a 1948 United Nations resolution. Members of the Israeli leadership say they're pleased with this open U.S. recognition of their claim to land seized by force from a neighboring territory. Israeli human rights activists and parliamentarians from the Israeli left are outraged and dismayed at the letter, which they say violates all international norms and undermines any possible peace talks. Uri Avneri, founder of Gush Shalom, the Israeli peace bloc.
Well, it is leading to a new Middle East, but a Middle East which will be much worse for the United States and for Israel. So if this is a new Middle East which Mr. Bush and Mr. Olmert had in mind, doesn't seem to be a very beautiful picture.
Bush's sweeping dismissal of international norms and regulations comes just as the Israeli government has itself taken a dramatic turn to the right, with the swearing-in of Avigdor Lieberman, best known for his frequent public calls for the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, as Minister of Strategic Affairs. This is a newly created position, initiated as part of a restructuring of the Israeli government called for by Lieberman. The restructuring puts increased power into the hands of the executive branch. Jonathan Cook, a political analyst in Israel.
80% of Palestinians living within what became the borders of Israel were ethnically cleansed during that war in 1948. So ethnic cleansing is not a new idea in Israeli politics. I mean, it's a very mainstream idea, and it's something that's been pursued right from the very beginning. For many years, Israeli politicians have been reluctant to talk openly about ethnic cleansing as a policy. But there's lots of evidence to suggest that ethnic cleansing has been pursued in limited forms ever since. But with Lieberman, what you're talking about really is wholesale ethnic cleansing. That's Lieberman's policy. And Olmert seems to be giving some kind of legitimacy to that policy now. And that, I would say, is an open declaration of war against the Palestinians.
And today, the Israeli parliament voted to approve a $12 billion war budget, the largest in Israeli history, after listening to talks by military commanders who told the parliament that Israel needs to be prepared for possible costly wars with Syria or Iran in the coming year. Mosi Raz, former Israeli parliamentarian.
The Israeli government policy is very extreme, very hawkish, that is refusing to negotiations with the Palestinians. This government went to a very, very stupid war in Lebanon and initiate very aggressive operations against the Palestinians in Gaza. They get the international support. Yes, they get the support.
Israeli forces appear to already be taking advantage of this new mandate, with the launch of a new offensive into the Gaza Strip that has left 13 Palestinians dead since yesterday. For FSRN, this is Jenka Soderberg reporting from Jerusalem.
People throughout the Americas and in Mexico in particular celebrate Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, a sacred day when the souls of the dead return to this world to visit the loved ones they left behind. Immigration advocates are taking this time to remember the thousands of migrants that have lost their lives at the border and worry about the possible consequences of tighter security measures. FSRN's Alonso Rivera reports from the Tijuana border.
Like every Day of the Dead since 1994, the year that Operation Gatekeeper tightened border security and diverted migrants to remote and dangerous areas, human rights defenders and immigration advocates hang crosses on the border fence as a way of honoring the men, women, and children who lost their lives in their pursuit of the American dream. Last weekend, artists and activists from San Diego and Tijuana placed a large paper skull on the border fence with the names of more than 4,000 migrants who have died while trying to cross the border illegally since Operation Gatekeeper began. Claudia Smith from the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation is one of those activists.
Every year we ask ourselves, how many more migrants will we have to honor next year? And every year there are hundreds more. This year, there were more than 400.
12 years have passed, and now migrants face a new danger, because last week, President Bush signed the Secure Fence Act, a law that authorizes the construction of 700 miles of additional fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border. For Claudia Smith, the new border fence will only result in more dead migrants.
The strategy consists of constantly pushing migrants away from populated areas, so it's harder for them to cross the border. So migrants will take even more terrible routes, where the possibility of being rescued are absolutely minimal. But migrants will keep trying to cross, even if it's under, over, or around those walls.
However, some social activists like Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America, believe the new wall will never be built because the funds have been authorized but have not yet been approved. Huerta added that one of the main detonators of migration is the exterior policies between the United States and Latin American countries.
The foreign policies we have with Mexico or Latin America are policies of economic colonization. We help other countries develop their economy. But for Mexico or Latin America, the policy is to take away their profits, their resources, and let people work for wages that they barely get by with.
With rising poverty levels in Mexico and a growing demand for inexpensive labor in the U.S., Migrant rights defenders like Father Luis Kensierski, head of a migrant shelter in Tijuana, believe that building fences will not put an end to undocumented immigration.
Migration is necessary for Mexico and for the United States. So what we see is that this will not necessarily stop migration. It will only divert it to tougher routes and elevate the cost of crossing. The immigration problem cannot be solved with walls.
Joel Montaño, a 21-year-old migrant from the southern state of Veracruz, is living proof that fences and increased border security will not keep migrants from trying to cross into the U.S.
If you really have a dream and you are determined to accomplish it, it doesn't matter if they put up 10 or 15 walls, you will succeed.
Joel will try to cross the desert into the U.S. this Friday without the help of a guide, because he can't afford the $1,500 fee. And as he participates in this year's holiday celebration, he prays that his name won't appear in a cross or a skull in next year's Dia de los Muertos celebration. In Tijuana, this is Alonso Rivera for Free Speech Radio News.
A third round of peace talks between Somalia's Islamic courts and the transitional government have stalled, rising fears of conflict. Both sides failed to meet face-to-face after 3 days of discussions in Sudan. The Islamists refuse to talk unless Ethiopian troops are withdrawn from Somalia. They have called for an international fact-finding mission to be sent to Somalia. Arab League, European Union, and African Union mediators urge both sides to exercise restraint.
Nigeria has appointed a new Sultan of Sokoto following the plane crash which killed the late Islamic leader, Colonel Sada Abubakar, son of the late Sultan Abubakar III, was chosen by a group of traditional rulers. His predecessor, Sultan Muhammadu Makido, and 95 others were killed on Sunday when the passenger jet they were traveling on crashed. The cause of the crash is being investigated.
At least 23 people were killed and more than 100,000 evacuated from their homes after a cyclone struck the Andhra Pradesh state in southern India. Most of those killed were working in paddy and shrimp farms in the southeastern district of Prakasam and Guntur. At least 400 villages and 15 towns were submerged in water. Weather experts say the storm is due to last at least another day.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 2nd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving, and our assistant producer and audio editor is Mike Monkbolt. Our wire editor is Jenna Thompson, and special thanks to reporters Jenna Thompson, Mike Monkbolt, Trillium Shannon, and Jody Darby. Our engineer this evening is Jeff Lovell. KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Marlise Franklin.
And I'm Sun Lee. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News at 7:30 a.m., here, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, it's APA Compass, featuring an interview with Helen Zia, music from Kid Cola, and a live panel discussion of Portland's resolution on the inclusion of immigrant and refugee communities. At 10:30, on Sounds of Awareness, host Paul Van Dyke interviews musician Nadia Russell. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all there. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. One final note, KBOO News is looking for more reporters to help us on election night, especially residents of Southern Washington and other areas outside of Portland Metro. Help us out by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thanks for joining us.
It is 6 o'clock. Coming up next is Africa on Fire, but first a little music.
Sisalindela, sithandazela, imvusele, elo enkulu iye,
yebo,
izamanje,
yebo,
izamanje, imvusele, elo enkulu iye. Tanda suko
temba
chembula lele limfusele
elo
enkulu iyeza uthembisile kuzobanjalo izibusi so kuwe nami bo kuzophuphuma kuzoxwaliswa imvusele
elo
enkulu iyeza izamanje
yebo
izamanje imvusele
lo
enkulu iyeza Tanda suko
lwe
tembula lele imvusele.
We're going to go to some announcements first, and then we'll be getting back to Africa on Fire.
Tune in Tuesday night, November 7th, for KBOO's live election night coverage. Our news and talk radio crew will be reporting live with candidate interviews, analysis, and up-to-date election returns from here and around the nation. Plus, a live house band. This Tuesday, the balance of Congress is at stake. So don't miss our special feature, a live Democrat-Republican Rock'em Sock'em Robot Thunderdome Grudge Match every hour. That's Tuesday, November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. on KBOO. And did I say live? Tune in and don't forget to vote.
Standing out here in the desert, trying to protect an oil line. I'd really like to do my job, but this ain't the country that I had in mind.
Friday, November 3rd, 6 to 7 p.m. Bread and Roses presents Bring the Troops Home Now, featuring Patricia Fucro. She's the producer of The Ground Truth, a war film made by soldiers themselves. Also, we'll have Oregon's own military families who are speaking out against the war. Tune in for action ideas on what you can do now to bring the troops home. That's Friday, November 3rd, 6 to 7 p.m. on Bread and Roses.
They don't keep anymore. Gotta fight the rich man's war.
Uprofetiwe shawogupela kuzotwali swangogutumisa bantwana betu bomemezela imvusele
elo
enkulu iyeza izamanje
yebo
izamanje imvusele
lo
enkulu iyeza tanda suko
lwe
tembula lele imvusele lo enkulu iyeza lindela mandla siswela loku ukhuthaze
Welcome to Africa on Fire on KBOO Radio. Africa on Fire is a news and public affairs broadcast committed to Africa and her people. Tonight, Africa on Fire elder consultants Grace Kuto and Bosco Conte join us. We'll hear a first-hand account about AIDS during the Reagan administration and learn about African harvest festivals. Plus more international and local African news the corporate media won't divulge. I'm your host, Marianne Fry. Join us for this special edition we call Africa Roundtable. Stay tuned. Africa is on fire.
Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire.
Local news and events later in the hour, but first, Africa on Fire's international African news. Joining me is Grace Kuto. The Johannesburg Stock Exchange punched through the 23,000 mark for the first time 2 weeks ago, closing at a record high. Investors reacted strongly to rising gold prices and recent measured hike in interest rates. The Business Day newspaper in Johannesburg reports stocks such as Edcon, Fashini, Standard Bank, and Absa had strong showings. In Kenya, a new plan for wealth has been unveiled. Kenya Vision 2030 was launched by President Kibaki last week. It's based on the premise that the so-called Asian tigers of Singapore, Thailand, and Malaysia were at the same stage of development as Kenya was 30 years ago. These Asian tigers moved themselves to industrialized and modern economies within one generation. The Kenya strategy targets an annual growth rate of 10% for the next 25 years. Officials expect individual incomes to increase from the current 33,000 shillings per year to more than 220,000. The current individual income of 33,000 shillings per year equals $459. The project has evaluated bids from leading international consulting teams, some with experience in the programs that transformed Singapore and Malaysia. Meanwhile, in Kenya, the Nation newspaper also reports that 30,000 Somali refugees are flooding Kenya to escape fighting in southern Somalia.
The East African paper in Nairobi reports that Congolese press have been a major contributing factor to the tense security situation in the country. As the Democratic Republic of Congo awaits the final leg of its presidential elections, tensions mount. Most of the media outlets in the DRC are owned by players in the same elections. Despite various agreements the candidates signed before the campaign to ensure peaceful elections, many of the media resorted to personal attacks against other candidates and at times resorted to ethnically slanted hate commentary. Observers are concerned that there aren't strong interventions to contain cross-partisan in the media, especially in the electronic media, and that violence might erupt after the final results are announced this month.
German officials announce Africa will be the focus of the 2007 G8 summit. The German cabinet is expected to propose that each G8 member would sign a partnership agreement with one African country. Germany's G8 proposal is reported to give preference to those countries that have political reforms underway, democracies in place, and are investor-friendly. Anne Jalimi of ActionAid calls on the German chancellor to set her sights higher than focusing on a handful of African countries. She says this will barely make a dent in problems, including malnutrition, AIDS, and 22 million girls who currently do not attend school. Jalimi said, "Across the board, rich countries need to drop the subsidies and tariffs that keep African farmers from making a living, cancel the debt burden that continues to eat up government budgets, and keep their promise to increase aid to 0.7% of the gross national income." Jalimi further stated, "If the G8 really cares about democracy in Africa, it will support genuine country-led processes rather than pushing reforms designed in Washington or Bonn."
The population of the United States recently hit 300 million people. Despite African stereotypes, it is China who leads the world's population at 1.3 billion, followed by India, the U.S., Indonesia, and Brazil. Rated third, The U.S. uses about 25 of the entire world's resources. The growing U.S. population is depleting the world's resources much faster than any other country. One example, U.S. water usage is 3 times higher than the world's average. According to Plain Wire, the U.S. ranks 29th in life expectancy at 77 years and Zambia at the bottom at 32. The U.S. is 7th in annual income at 43,000, while Burundi, East Africa, is last at $100 per year. The U.S. ranks last among 21 donors in overall development assistance relative to national wealth. The United States devotes 0.13% of gross national income to such efforts. Denmark rates first, according to the World Population Organization.
A line of merchandise targeted at saving African lives has debuted. Activists Bono and Bobby Shriver recently unveiled Product Red. The Gap retail store now sells clothing, mostly red, with words like admired, inspired, and centered, highlighting the ending letters that spell red. 50% of each Gap Product Red goes to the Global Fund to Fight HIV in Africa. According to O Magazine, Gap is sponsoring a pilot HIV/AIDS health intervention project at the Lesotho factory that manufactures its red T-shirts. Converse, Giorgio Armani, and Motorola have also signed 5-year deals to develop, manufacture, and market products under the red name. And finally, girls' education to secondary or higher levels are at much less risk of contracting HIV, according to a new report. Reviewing over 600 pieces of research on girls' education, sexual behavior, and HIV, ActionAid reports that secondary education provides African girls with the power to make sexual choices that prevent HIV infection. These girls wait before having sex and are much more likely to use condoms when they do have sex. Girls who drop out of school are more likely to enter into adult sexual networks that routinely offer less protection. Poverty and vulnerability to HIV are, of course, closely related. You've been listening to International African News on Africa on Fire. I'm Marianne Fry with Grace Kuto. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the first diagnosis of AIDS. Over 100 countries have pledged to ensure universal access to AIDS prevention, treatment, and care by 2010. However, despite these grand promises, countries and donors are failing to launch the type of large-scale prevention efforts that are needed to reverse the spread of HIV. As World AIDS Day approaches on December 1st, the AIDS epidemic continues to evolve. There are 13,500 new HIV infections every day. When we return, we'll hear a firsthand story about AIDS during the Reagan administration. Africa on Fire elder consultants are here with a special program edition called Africa Roundtable. Vital community leaders, author Grace Kuto hails from Kenya and is the vice president of Portland area Harambe Center. Bosco Conte of Ghana is the president of the African Community Coalition of Oregon. Okay, good job.
Hello, this is Africa on Fire, and this is segment one, Africa Roundtable, with Basco Kante and Grace Kuto. Hello, Grace.
Hello, Basco. It's so good to see you today.
Yes. This evening we're going to discuss two items. The first item is going to be on AIDS in Africa, and the second item would be about harvest, African harvest. So, yes, Grace, what do you have for us on AIDS?
Oh, I don't have very much. I just wanted to share an experience that I consider to be firsthand when it comes to the epidemic of AIDS in Africa. And during the Reagan administration, there was a law in place that prevented anyone from any part of the world to come to the United States if they tested HIV positive. And it was during that administration that I needed to get my permanent resident visa to the United States. So one had to go back to their own originating country and go through all the tests. And one of the tests was to test for HIV. During the early 80s, around 1983, 1982. Actually, this is the 25th year since HIV/AIDS was first discovered in this country or anywhere in the world. And around 1983 and before 1983, I had received some blood transfusion, blood products. And at the time that I received those blood products, the blood was not being tested
properly
to see if there was AIDS, because we didn't know about AIDS.
Exactly.
But it was also around that time that they found a lot of contamination in the blood with AIDS, and as a result, quite a few people were infected and they died from it. I was a recipient of some of the blood products during that very same time when the blood was contaminated. So when I had to go back home during the Reagan administration time, I had to get the HIV test, and I cannot tell you how traumatized I was going through that experience, just waiting.
I believe it.
And because I went through that, and I know how it felt just to wait, I often think about people that actually have the virus and how they just must, you know, feel just waiting for their last day on earth. I truly, truly know how traumatizing that should be, that is. I don't know, because I don't have the virus. I don't know how they feel, but I know that it's very traumatizing just to even have a thought that, you know, you might have it.
Yeah. With regards to the issue you just raised up, and I even know that back at home or in Ghana and many other parts of Africa, people who are infected generally stay away from their hometowns. They would rather stay in the village where they acquired the town where they acquired the disease, until they're just about to die before they get home to die.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the stigma that they're afraid to bring it to their families, to their relatives, their parents, and all that. So it's still a big hit. But the other question now I'd like to ask you is, don't you see that this AIDS issue back at home is generally confined to the tourist areas back at home?
Originally it was.
Yeah.
Originally it was confined to those areas, but very, very quickly it spread throughout the populations. Especially for East Africa, there's a tracking
companies.
Tracking companies, a tracking route,
yes,
where trucks go through different countries delivering goods. In East Africa, the biggest effect on how fast it spread came through that particular route,
mm-hmm,
as the truck drivers went along
from place to place.
So very, very fast it spread throughout, you know, most of the rural areas.
Yes.
As people worked in the city, those that contracted the disease from those tourist areas brought it back home to their wives and, you know, their families and to others that they had sexual interaction with.
And generally, when a truck driver acquires it and then passes on to his wife or wives in the house, is that because the person has several wives. That's why it affects everybody in the house. Or apart from those wives, he also goes out to other people somewhere else. Is that what is causing the expansion?
It depends on different countries.
Yes.
A lot of countries in Africa, I believe, do allow polygamy in marriage relationships. So yes, people, you know, men have more than one wife, and so quite often all the wives are infected. And then when this person dies off,
yes,
then these wives in some of the countries are inherited by somebody else from his family.
That's right.
Who probably was not infected,
yes,
at the time.
Mm-hmm.
When he inherits these wives,
mm-hmm,
he gets infected, and then he gives it back to his own family.
Yes.
So it's
in
just,
addition to new ones.
Exactly. So it spreads really, really fast.
Yeah. Then the other issue about AIDS is that also is that anytime someone is talking about AIDS, they just say AIDS in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering why people are not do not take their time to say AIDS in Kenya, AIDS in Uganda, AIDS in Ghana, or, you know, they would just give some statistic and say the AIDS pandemic is growing at this fast pace in Africa. Whilst we know that there are certain parts of Africa where the incidence is very, very low.
That's true. And I think that goes back to the question of Africa is not a country. And I think we often talk about that particular issue in terms of if we are referring to a specific country in Africa, we should name the country, we should name the region, just so that the audience or people that are getting this information know that we're not talking about the whole continent. In fact, today I do have some statistics on incidences of AIDS in Africa.
Very good.
And as I look through the statistics, you can see, you know, where AIDS is more prevalent,
okay,
than other parts.
Yes, please go ahead.
It seems so much more prevalent in East Africa, okay, and in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. Those countries have the highest numbers. For example, Kenya, people that are living with AIDS, there are 1,300,000 people. In Uganda, there are 1,000,000. These are estimated statistics, you know, given by United Nations. And Zimbabwe also, which is not quite in East Africa, but a little more south of East Africa, is 1,700,000. Tanzania is 1,400,000. Now, those are the high numbers.
Yes.
When we take another country that has very, very low incidences, for example, Senegal has only 61,000 people living with AIDS. When you go to, when you go to Gambia,
yes,
there are only 20,000 people living with HIV virus. Equatorial Guinea, there are only 8,000 people. So that demonstrates how big Africa is. And when we say, gosh, there's so much AIDS in Africa, yes, there is a lot of AIDS in Africa, a lot of people infected by the virus in Africa. But it does vary from region to region. Of all the numbers all over Africa that are infected, actually all over the world, we have 42 million people infected, people that are living with HIV AIDS.
That's the whole continent?
That's just the whole world.
Oh, I see.
But 74% of that number is in Africa. So when you take that 74% and put in Africa, it's a very large number, but then you have to look at specific countries.
Okay. And again, when we talk about AIDS, generally, especially the infection rate, I was inclined to think that because of the preponderance of the illiterate folks in Africa, a lot of people in the villages who are not able to read and write, so they are not able to take care of themselves hygienically.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, they are not able to help their immune systems, so they die off easily or quicker than many other places in the world. So
that could be part of the reason, but I think the main reason more Africans are dying from AIDS is because at this point in time, they're not having ready access to the medications,
yes,
that could help them prolong life.
Yes.
Again, going back to what I described earlier and how a lot of Africans get AIDS, through marriage relationships, it spreads really fast. And so there are many, many factors that do not, that are not the same for the Western, for the Western world in how AIDS is contracted. And then once it's contracted, how it is treated. And so, and then you come to the stigma. That's another whole issue in Africa as well.
You are listening to Africa on Fire. This is the Round Africa Roundtable Conference and the segment. And we'll be moving to the next segment after a short break.
Sisalindela, sithandazela, imvusele, elo enkulu iye,
yebo,
izamanje,
yebo,
izamanje, imvusele. Suko
Temba
Tembula Lele Infusele
Elo
Enkulu Iyeza Utembisile Kuzo Banjalo Izibusi Sogu Enami Kuzophuphuma kuzoxwaliswa imvusele
elo
enkulu iyeza
izamanje
bo izamanje imvusele
lo
enkulu iyeza tanda suko
Temba
Tembula Lele Imvusele
Elo.
This is Africa on Fire and you are listening to Basco Kante and Grace Kuto. We are on our second segment of Africa Roundtable and the discussion here is not going to be based on African harvest festivals. So Grace, could you start us off or you want me to go ahead with it?
Well, I'm going to have you share a lot of information on the harvest festivals because I know from East Africa, we know that this is a much richer experience in West Africa. And just here in Portland, as we have experienced a little bit of the harvest festivals or just the African spirit, especially through some of our musicians here in town from West Africa. I do know that, you know, West Africa has a very, very, very rich heritage in the Harvest Festival. So I would like to invite you to share some of your own experiences as you grew up, what you experienced as a child. And, you know, I know that put in the African spirit in you that still lives in you.
Thank you. Yes, it is true that these Harvest Festivals are quite special back at home. And they vary from country to country, from tribe to tribe. And for example, in Accra, in Ghana, for example, the southern part is mostly coastal, especially Accra and Cape Coast area. That's coastal. So most of their farming is done with fishing is their main activity. And so a lot of their ceremonies will be around fish.
You know,
the time when do they harvest the fish and when can they have the ceremonies to indicate that they now want to thank the gods and the one god that we all pray to that has given them a good harvest or a bad harvest. Now, as you move hinterland, and most of them farm rice, yams, sorghum and maize, and then granules and beans. So it is when all these things are done, normally those harvest periods start from about July, August, and then go down to about November, December. So it is when all these things are done, then sometimes in a particular tribe, they are either the chief or the fetish, the landowner. Mm-hmm. The Europeans will call him a fetish priest.
Mm-hmm.
He would then announce that all the harvest is complete. And so as from next week, second cycle time, people are free to eat what has been given them. But before the eating is done, there are certain ceremonies that they need to perform. And most of the heads of households will get together. Mm-hmm. And then they'll perform these ceremonies. And when they get back home, then the feast starts. Then the food is cooked. The food is the grains that have been harvested is displayed. And then they begin to dry them up so that they can put them into barns and stuff. But for that whole week, people have festivities and they enjoy the fruits of their labor.
Do children in the family, young children or the youth, do they have any special part to play during those ceremonies or are they mainly observers?
Like I said, this thing varies from tribe to tribe and varies from country to country. Mm-hmm. Today I was talking to some of the countries in Africa, you know, East Africa, Somaliland, Sudan area, mm-hmm. and Liberia, Sierra Leone. You know, it varies from tribe to tribe or country to country. But generally, since the ceremony involves elders, mm-hmm. it's something to do, it's spiritual. Okay. It's the elder people who do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most of the women do not participate outside the house during the ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
They will be preparing the food, and it is that food that will be given to the elders, more often than not, the older people in the family and the household, or the among who work with the fetish priest. They will go and do this ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a prayer, almost like a church service, you would call it here in the West. And when that is done, then people then go back to their homes. And that's where the children participate in the eating, mm-hmm. and in the drumming, mm-hmm. and the women bring in the food, and then there's a lot of singing and dancing. It is not usual for harvest festivals to have a parade,
mm-hmm.
a parade around the city.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it's not so. You don't parade and go like a Christmas, how we do it at home, where you go from house to house. But with the harvest, you could go to relatives' homes,
mm-hmm.
to eat. But more often than not, this is in a clan. You do it clan by clan.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to one particular clan, and that's where you share some of the fruits. That is mainly the cooking, but not the raw harvest that has been done.
And I would imagine that also a lot of music is involved in that, a lot of drumming.
Yes, during the eating, there is a lot less drumming.
Okay.
And that's where some of the children who are up and coming, they would do, if they know how to drum, they would drum.
Okay.
Or their parents would let them participate in it so that they get to know.
Okay.
The songs that are involved with the harvest, which is mainly thanking the gods or the God Almighty for giving them a good harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's not so good, even if it's a poor harvest, they will still have the festival.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't celebrate as big. People would not be as happy as they would normally be. But they will always have the celebration and will thank the gods for giving them the good rains, which resulted in the good produce and then the harvest.
And I'm wondering too, just knowing what happens in East Africa, what is the economic impact of these harvests?
Generally, as you know, most of the productions back at home is subsistence production,
mm-hmm.
which is that a family would have 1 to 2 or 3, at most 3 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And what they produce is basically for consumption. Whatever is left over will be used to be taken to the market and sold so that they could pay their taxes,
mm-hmm.
the head poll, as we call it, mm-hmm. the poll tax,
mm-hmm.
as well as they use some of the revenues if they sold any items to buy cloth for the children, for their wives, or a particular dress for the head of the household or men of the house,
mm-hmm.
to expect. Basically, another thing they would do with the money is buying clothes that are to be kept for funerals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when there is a funeral or when somebody dies, he's supposed to be dressed in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
and normally it you have to use, you have to go, sometimes they go outside their tribe to buy the cloth that is used in the burial.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be bought somewhere, it has to be sown and then kept in anticipation of the death.
Wow.
So when that death happens, then the cloth is available.
That is so interesting because in my part of Africa, which is East Africa, you just don't do that.
you don't anticipate death.
We do anticipate death, but you know, someone says, don't wish me death. So that is so interesting to hear about that part.
Yeah.
We know death is coming and, you know, we anticipate it, but you just don't, you know,
prepare for it.
You don't prepare for it.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting, and that's why we keep talking about Africa is not a country. There's so many very different cultures. And as you were talking about the harvest in the West African part of Africa, I just thought about a particular experience for myself when I was very, very young during a harvest season when families, you were supposed to bring some of your harvest to the chief's home. And I remember my family when we gathered, you know, whatever we needed to bring. It was a very exciting experience. I had a new dress on, and I was anticipating this long journey to the chief. I had never seen the chief.
Yeah.
We were anticipating seeing the chief and just, you know, celebrating at his home. But it was a very, very long way to walk.
Yes.
And we walked, and I had my own part of the harvest to carry. And of course, I didn't carry it all the way because it was too far and I got too tired on the way. So we eventually got there, but I paid a big price. By the time we got there, my feet were swollen.
Yeah.
And I think I was about 7 years old, maybe eight. And but I just I remember the excitement that I had as we were going to the chief's place, you know, a big, big place.
For the harvest.
So and that excitement is, you know, goes throughout the harvest time.
Yeah.
When you have the special events.
But presently, I would say that the harvest, it's not that I don't want to say it is dying off.
Mm-hmm.
It's not celebrated as grandiose as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Accra, in Ghana, the people from Accra, they are in the capital city. And they are surrounded by a lot of foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
So they have improved upon the way it is celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
And they continue to make it big from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of harvest, eating of food, a lot of fish is available. You visit friends and you eat that. So, but in the other smaller regions or smaller towns and villages, as I said, it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
The clans will do it and then... And that will be the end of it. The biggest occasions now that may be substituting for this harvest is the Easter celebrations.
Mm.
Yeah, in Ghana in particular, it's a big occasion, Easter and Christmas.
Okay.
And now it appears even Easter is getting bigger than Christmas, where a lot of people from abroad, people from various parts of the country will go to their hometown. In trucks, in big, big trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll spend 3, 4, 5 days having a big feast, parties in the parks. They go to the schools and rent, get permission to use the school grounds and have these parties.
Yeah.
So women get new clothes at that time. Children, they buy clothes for them. And then there is merrymaking going on. So maybe in the future... If we are not careful, the harvest might die and the Easter and Christmas might take over.
Well, I don't think it will die really because we will always harvest. We will always harvest, whether it's fish, crops, whatever. I think we'll always harvest. And in the African sense, that is such a strong, strong heritage in terms of just the spiritual sense of things. And I think that's the best time for children, really. Any part of the year, I think that's the best time for children. You have a little more around the house. Even economically, you know, people can afford a little more. And that's when children get new clothes, preparing for Christmas time. When we were growing up, we only got one dress per year. and it was during the harvest time.
Oh, my Lord.
And it was, I remember when I was little, it was such a long year.
Yeah, period.
Long, long year.
Waiting.
Because you waited for that dress for a whole year. And now that we're here and, you know, older, the year just, you know, zips right by. So
yeah.
I do remember harvest time with very fond memories.
Yeah, yeah, and like I was talking about the new clothes, at Christmas now in Ghana, it is usual for people to buy new clothes for their loved ones and especially for their children. They have new clothes at Christmas. So everybody is looking forward to Christmas. That idea is so much ingrained in the people that we, those who live outside the country, anytime we come back home at Christmas time, everyone expects us to bring something from home, however small.
In this country, when you go back to school the first of the year, children, when they go back to school, the first thing they ask is, what did you get at Christmas time? You know, all these electronic toys and all these, you know, incredible gifts that, you know, this country can offer.
Yeah.
For the African children, they get an outfit. And I know in my time it was like that. I know in my country it is still the same.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go back, you want to show off your new outfits.
That is nice. That is nice.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is a very interesting discussion, and I'm sure that we will continue with it next time. You have been listening to Africa on Fire, Africa Roundtable, our second segment and last segment for the evening. When we come back, we'll have some more local news for you. Thanks. This is KBOO in Portland, and you are on Africa on Fire. Currently, we are on the Africa Roundtable segment. We would like to add one more thing in our discussion. Since we are, this is Christmas time, Christmas is coming pretty soon. It might be interesting for us to talk a little bit about our ideas about Christmas back at home and how it relates to our experiences here in the U.S., or in Portland in particular. So, Sister Grace, what do you say about Christmas?
Well, Christmas is a very, very rich time in Africa. I think this is where I can say Africa is a country. It's experienced in pretty similar ways. It's definitely a harvest. It's a celebration, just like it is around other parts of the world. But, of course, we do celebrate differently. In this country, there's a lot of gift-giving going on, especially for children and other members of the family. In Africa, much of the gift-giving is really from the heart of the people. very often, especially families that live in rural areas, they really don't have gifts to give, other than because they have plenty of crop now that they have harvested. They cook for each other. Those are the gifts of, you know, from each other. A lot of food as a gift. The gifts that come from the heart are just giving of themselves to each other, spending time with each other, sharing memories that they usually don't have time to share, just letting each other know that I'm here for you. What is your problem? When someone says hello and say, how are you? You tell them a story that lasts maybe 10-15 minutes. That's your response in hello.
Yes.
And that happens a lot around Christmas time because people have more time, they're more willing to spend with each other. It's really a gift they give of each other.
That is quite true, Sister Grace. Even back in Ghana when I was growing up too, I don't recall any gifts that I got from anybody except my parents would give me a shirt or some new shoe or something to prepare me for school after the New Year's. But what was prevalent was the amount of food that was cooked in various houses. And we, the children, we would attend some church. Those who attend churches, but those who are not Christians or Muslims, would just get together and go from house to house as boys and girls. And then we'll get to your house and you have some food. We just all sit down together and eat it. And then we'll just go. Other places, you go to those who have been to school, to their homes, they'll give you some biscuits. That's what they normally give.
Yes.
So we just go there. The kids will just stand by and they'll give each one of us a handful of biscuits. Okay. Then we'll continue from house to house. It was quite lovely. And then in the evenings, the older people will generally go to what we call a disco. It's an open air dance with a live band.
Okay.
And we, the kids, will be hanging out, just listen to the music, and the big guys will be dancing and drinking and eating. So it's really a fun time at home. And like you know, Christmas time at home, the weather is excellent.
Yes, very hot.
Nobody is indoors, so everybody's having a good time outside.
Yes, so Christmas here, of course, part of the identity of Christmas here is the snow, the white snow.
The white snow.
And with those of us that come from Africa, we're saying, where's the sun? So that is a big contrast between United States or the Western world and Africa, of course.
Yes.
And so I think another main difference also is how much time we spend in church on Christmas Day.
Yes.
No matter what day of the week Christmas falls on.
Yes.
Most people, those that are Christians at least, and probably Muslims as well.
Oh yeah, we go to
them. They spend most of that day at church.
Yes.
Interacting with each other, doing songs, and just sharing the meaning of Christmas in depth.
Yeah.
So that's another big difference, I think, within the United States and Africa.
That's quite true.
It's the favorite time of the children. Your new dress, your guaranteed one.
That is quite true. I remember, like I said, at home, we would go to, I used to attend Assemblies of God Church. So during the week, we'll be preparing during the day and afternoon. Then on Christmas Day itself, there will be dances in town. So we'll go to church maybe around 5:30, 4:30 in the afternoon. And by 6, it's done. And we're told that we should come back by midnight. So people will go to the dance halls. We're dancing around 11:30. Everybody's leaving the dance place. The band stops. Everybody rushes to his or her church. And they go to prayer. And then in about 2 hours' time, by 1:30, 2 o'clock, they are back again at the dancing halls.
So that's another difference between West Africa and East Africa. For us, we just go to church and we just focus
stay
on
there.
Church. And then when we go home, we just eat together, visit with family.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there are other groups that usually would go and do the dancing.
Yes.
And those usually prefer to, you know, to go and have parties that way as opposed to going to church. So you see a big difference between the two groups.
Yes.
In terms of how they celebrate.
And the most enlightening thing for me as I think back is the interaction between the Muslim group and the Christians. Whether one is Christian, you cannot tell. If one is Christmas time, you can't tell who is Muslim, who is Christian.
Really?
We are doing it together.
And that's good to learn. For me, that's good to learn because in East Africa, we're predominantly Christian.
I see.
And so we don't have a lot of interaction between the Muslims and the Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting.
And so as Christmas is coming up, you know, this is actually, I believe this is our last show before the year ends.
That's right.
So we want to wish everyone a very
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. The
yes.
stores are already doing it, beckoning us to come and do shopping for Christmas. So for us too, we want to give you an early, early Merry Christmas wish. And as you celebrate Christmas this year, we would ask that...
Go ahead.
Okay, as we celebrate Christmas this year, we ask that you take some time and just think about gifts of the heart, as opposed to just going to the store and purchasing someone and giving to someone. Share something of your heart. You don't have to buy something. You can just share of yourself.
Exactly, yes.
So we encourage you to do that more this Christmas.
Yeah, and we wish everyone a Merry Christmas. Be safe, take care of yourself, and take care of everybody, because that is their spirit. We are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon. And this is the program Africa on Fire. And we just concluded the Africa Roundtable with Basco Kante and Grace Kuto.
For Africa on Fire's local and regional news. Last Wednesday, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Association announced the launch of an Africa House. The community has long awaited this type of a venture. ERCO bills their project as a one-stop service center for African refugees and immigrants. ERCO was recently awarded a grant from the Federal Office of Resettlement, Refugee Resettlement. The three-year, $200,000 grant will pay for staffing and operation of an Africa House site. Jimmy Dogo of Chad will lead ERCO's Africa House project. Here's an update from our recent program with Somali Casey Jama. 2 weeks ago, the Portland City Council unanimously passed a resolution reaffirming the city's commitment to the inclusion of immigrants and refugees in civic and public life. In addition to the resolution, a task force is to be created. The group will be charged with identifying barriers to immigrant and refugee inclusion and exploring workable solutions with the city. And the follow-up to the October 19th City Council hearing, proposal to eliminate racial profiling by the Portland Police, Mayor Tom Potter promised to return to the council within 60 days with a timeline for setting up a racial profiling commission.
The Egyptian government has loaned out the largest selection of antiquities to ever come to North America. Starting Sunday, that exhibit comes to Portland. The Portland Art Museum displays over 100 artifacts from the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, the Luxor Museum, and the sites of Tanis and Del Bahari. Explore ancient Egyptian beliefs about the afterlife, including walking through the replica tomb. The exhibit runs from November 5th through March 4th of 2007. For more information on tickets and museum hours, visit portlandartmuseum.org or call 503-226-2811.
The documentary Lost Boys of Sudan will be shown next week. Filmmaker Megan Mylan and Lost Boy Isaac Chole will lead after-film discussions. Portland showings will be Tuesday, November 7th at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland, and also Wednesday, November 8th at Portland Community College, Cascade Campus, Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building at North Killingsworth in Albina. Both events begin at 6:15 p.m. For more information, contact worldoregon.org. Life expectancy in Zimbabwe, Botswana, Swaziland, Malawi, and Zambia is less than 40 years. Join Africa AIDS Response on Thursday, November 30th for a Rhythm of Life benefit concert for Portland's sister city of Matare, Zimbabwe. Dinner and live auction begins at 6 p.m. with Love Nisweisa and Kagotso African Cultural Arts. A silent auction with music from Chika Marimba begins at 7, followed by blues, funk, and R&B with the Lloyd Jones Struggle at 8 p.m. It's at the Tiffany Center on Southwest 14th and Morrison Streets in Portland. For more information about ticket prices or donations, call 503-284-3355 or email info@AfricaAIDSResponse.org.
The World Affairs Council presents a Teach Africa Conference. The conference for kindergarten through 12th grade educators will be held on December 9th. New materials and methodologies using interactive models of instruction about Africa will be introduced. For more information, contact Karen Ettinger at 503-274-7488 or karen@worldoregon.org. Help organize events about genocide. The Portland Coalition for Genocide Awareness seeks area to help organize local events about genocide. You can contact this new grassroots organization by calling Sarah at 503-282-1108.
It's First Thursday here at Africa on Fire and also in the Pearl. Tonight until 8:30 p.m., local artist Baba Wage Jakate presents large ceramic sculptures depicting life in his birthplace of Mali. It's at the Polium Deffenbaugh Gallery, 929 Northwest Flanders Street. If you don't catch it tonight, the exhibit runs through December 2nd. The gallery number is 503-228-6665. The nonprofit organization Bola Moya presents Southern Cuisine Music Market and an auction for their youth center project in Malawi. The event is Monday, November 13th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at Screen Door Restaurant, 2337 East Burnside in Portland. Reservations are required by Tuesday, which is November 7th. Call 503-508-8899 for more information. Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars will perform at Portland's Wonder Ballroom, 128 Northeast Russell, next Saturday, November 11th. More information at wonderballroom.com. For world culture and dance programs featuring African dance, contact Carrie Hill DiCantero at 503-320-4911. Seattle African events are at ibike.org/Africa Matters. If you missed any of this, send us an email at africaonfire@yahoo.com. Thanks to our elder consultants Grace Couto and Bosco Conte for their wisdom in tonight's Africa Roundtable. We'll hear more from them on our Africa on Fire program first Thursday in January. Engineer is KBOO board member Judy Feistel. Theme song was produced by Vancouver's African Gospel a cappella. For Africa on Fire, I'm host and founder Marianne Fry. Africa is the cradle of civilization. How else are you connected to the great continent of light? Africa is on fire.
Oh, Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa.
Tune in Tuesday night, November 7th, for KBOO's live election night coverage. Our news and talk radio crew will be reporting live with candidate interviews, analysis, and up-to-date election returns from here and around the nation. Plus, a live house band. This Tuesday, the balance of Congress is at stake. So don't miss our special feature, a live Democrat-Republican Rock'em Sock'em Robot Thunderdome Grudge Match every hour. That's Tuesday, November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. on KBOO. And did I say live? Tune in and don't forget to vote.
Standing out here in the desert, trying to protect an oil line. I'd really like to do my job, but this ain't the country that I had in mind.
Friday, November 3rd, 6 to 7 p.m. Bread and Roses presents Bring the Troops Home Now, featuring Patricia Fucreau. She's the producer of The Ground Truth, a war film made by soldiers themselves. Also, we'll have Oregon's own military families who are speaking out against the war. Tune in for action ideas on what you can do now to bring the troops home. That's Friday, November 3rd, 6 to 7 p.m. on Bread and Roses.
They don't keep